Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The longer you're unemployed, the harder it gets to find a job. And many Americans have been unemployed for months, even years.
My husband's been unemployed since May.
I was unemployed for 5 months.
Leaving me without a job at the age of 52.
I've been unemployed for 2.5 years.
I've been unemployed for over a year.
Tomorrow, I will be joining the ranks of the unemployed.
But joblessness is not just an economic hardship. It affects all aspects of your life, with sometimes devastating impacts on your family, increased rates of depression, and social isolation.
There is no option for me. What happens to the unemployed?
Life without a job. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 11th, and the takeaway for me is that the personal and cultural repercussions of long-term unemployment may actually last a lot longer than any of the economic aftershocks.
The stress that doesn't go away, I think
that's right.
Fair to say. Let's get right to the top stories we are following this morning. Just breaking out of Brussels, the president of the European Union says an agreement has now been reached. European leaders were gathering there in Brussels. An agreement has now been reached to restructure the debt of Greece, which has weighed so hard on the markets, and the announcement of an agreement is likely to move the markets later on today. Iran marks the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution with a chilling announcement. That's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad declaring Iran is now a nuclear state because it's produced its first batch of 20% enriched uranium, far below weapons grade. The sound of a sea of government supporters in Tehran, hundreds of thousands strong, approving of Ahmadinejad's speech. Meanwhile, anti-government protesters are being attacked by riot police who are firing tear gas to disperse them and paintballs to mark them for later arrest. Earlier, we spoke to Akbar, a resident of Tehran, who didn't want us to use his full name. He told us the government there has again clamped down on all forms of media.
Absolutely every sound that is made is registered by the government. It's an absolute police state.
Today's rally comes hours after President Obama placed new sanctions on Iran, specifically its Revolutionary Guard.
Here at home, the White House is rolling out a positive economic forecast this morning. A report by the Council of Economic Advisers says the country is likely to average 95,000 more jobs each month this year. It also says credit will stay tight and personal savings will increase. But it'll be a while until all the jobs lost in the Great Recession come back. We're joined now by Donald Jones. He's been unemployed for the first time at age 60. He used to sell photographic equipment before he was laid off. Donald, how long have you been unemployed?
It's going on about a year and a half now.
Have you found that the long-term unemployment has affected you in some surprising ways?
You know, I think your job is such a huge part of your identity, and you're used to being a provider for your family, and you sort of feel an isolation, even though in Detroit you're not exactly isolated when you're unemployed, but you still feel as though you're kind of on the outside looking in.
We're going to explore that more with you, Donald Jones. Stay with us.
So in Haiti, Reuters is reporting the American missionaries charged with kidnapping will be released and freed as early as today. There's no confirmation on that, but the judge in the case is widely expected to rule on whether to proceed with a trial. There are snowblowers clearing sidewalks near the U.S. Capitol building this morning. Washington, Baltimore, and Philadelphia broke their records for most snow in a single winter during yesterday's blizzard, and the federal government is shut for the fourth consecutive day.
Taking a look at the markets, Asian markets are up, and futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,038. The S&P opens at 1,068 and the NASDAQ at 2147. Coming up, we talk about tonight's broadcast of the White House series of civil rights music with members of the Howard University Choir, who you hear singing right there with a Negro spiritual written by the director of the choir. That's later this hour.
So the psychiatric community is debating new labels, new names for psychiatric disorders. How much do you think that helps? Tell us your story of how a label has changed your life. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, unemployment, a long-term issue.
We'll be right back.
Our most urgent task is job creation.
This is a very tough economy.
20,000 jobs were lost last month.
And it's probably going to rise further before it starts to come down
again. So when I feel 10, 8, I don't know. I just know I'm unemployed.
Jobs, jobs, jobs. We need jobs. I don't have kids. My husband and I don't own a home. We need jobs.
Take some time for jobs to get created again.
At this point, there are 6 unemployed people in the United States for every job that's available. That's a record high. Another record high is the amount of time that people remain unemployed. It's now at 31 weeks. That's the highest it's been since they started keeping those records. We're joined now by Donald Jones. He's 60 years old and has been unemployed for a year and a half. And Donald, the thing that fascinates me about your story is that you grew up with a grandfather who lost his job during the Great Depression and would tell you stories about how you should never take things for granted, and you were kind of scoffing it off, right? You're saying, oh, Grandpa, come on.
Yeah, exactly. We were sort of brought up in a security type of thing where we didn't have to worry about it. You know, there was things taken for granted, I think, and he used to tell me stories. Actually, the grandfather on the one side of the family was brought up through the General Motors Corporation, so they put him through law school, and I think he got through it relatively unscathed, but on my mother's side, he was the beneficiary of the WPA program, so that he found work when the government came through with some money to repair the roads and whatnot.
Did you ever think that at age 60 you would be back in the same place that your grandfather was?
No, I never thought in a million years that I would. Like I said, we were sort of coming up thinking that things were secure, and we felt, you know, that there was going to be work. In what we did, if you did a good job and stuff, and that, you would have some form of security.
Let's talk now to Hashim Yeomans-Benford. He's a community organizer with the Miami Workers Center. It's a nonprofit that promotes racial and economic justice. Hashim, you work with minority communities in Miami. Have you seen the same people coming in month after month after month looking for services?
Yeah, I think the number has definitely increased. And, you know, what we've seen in our community is a problem go from bad to worse, because really in working communities and in communities of color, we've been in a recession for the last 30 years in reality. And so the recent spike in unemployment and the recent housing crisis have really turned that recession into a depression.
Well, how have you seen people's maybe demeanor or their attitudes change as the months go on and they remain unemployed? Do they begin to lose some sense of hope, or as Donald was talking about earlier, do they begin to lose some of their identity?
Yeah, I think definitely unemployment, when you talk about unemployment, we have to realize that it has a very destabilizing effect in people's lives. And so we see it affect people at the individual level. We have a family that is a part of our organization. The mother and the father worked and paid bills for many years, but the types of jobs that are often available in our communities offer little job security and no benefits. So in 2008, they lost their jobs. They were forced to move in with some relatives. That home ultimately went into foreclosure. And what happens is that kind of kicks off a cycle that's very hard to get out of, because it's very hard to have a job when you don't have a stable home. It's hard to find work. Then it has psychological impacts on the children. And so in communities where unemployment is very high, this destabilizing effect in individual homes turns into the destabilization of the community as a whole, which has pretty big political impacts as people are forced to move, so it changes the dynamics of electorates. And as more and more communities become destabilized, we start having a national crisis, and it actually becomes a national security question.
So, Donald Jones, we have a recording of a song. This is a song that you wrote back in 1980, which was another economic downturn, but it suddenly had new meaning for you after you lost your job.
Bank man, text man, got me on the run. Money's all gone, so is all my fun. Can't find a job, nowhere to be free. Better not mess with my dignity.
Better not mess with my dignity. You know, Donald, this can be a sensitive subject, but for people who experience long-term unemployment, there are psychological issues that are associated with that. Losing your dignity, you talked about losing your sense of identity, and there's also senses of isolation and depression that come along when you go week after week, month after month without a job.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You start to look at yourself worth, and it really does take a beating. You go places like the grocery store or whatever, and there's people working, and it might be a place that you applied for where you haven't been able to get a job there, and you think, well, you know, I'm out here and there and there. It's it does start to take a hit on you. I think it really helps, like the gentleman said that you were just talking to get politically active. We have things in Detroit here where we fight against the foreclosure. We have the People's Summit and places like that. And I think it helps to get out and try to make a difference in it. You know, it does make a difference if you get involved, and it gets rid of some of the anger, too.
That's Donald Jones. Hashim, you're hearing Donald Jones from Detroit, a 60-year-old, and he's been unemployed for a year and a half. You, in your work with the community organization in Miami, must see people like that all the time. Do you have people that come in needing reassurance? Are they questioning their own self-worth?
I think more than anything, what happens is people become disillusioned with a lot of the stories we're told about what this country is supposed to be and what opportunity is supposed to look like. And, you know, the role of an organization like ours, and, you know, there's many of us across the country that do this work, is to try to organize those people and put pressure on the state to provide the type of solutions that are actually going to address the deeper systemic issues behind this unemployment. So to try to take, those psychological questionings and the anger and try to focus that to get politically active, like Don said, and actually get some real solutions implemented
in
our communities.
Hashim Yeomans-Benford is a community organizer with the Miami Workers Center. That's a local nonprofit in Miami that promotes racial and economic justice. Donald Jones, unemployed for the first time at age 60. He used to sell photographic equipment. He joined us from Detroit. Donald actually is a listener who called us with his story back in November, and we encourage all of
that.
You.
Yeah,
it's a very, very powerful story. So we return to him to get more from him. And if you're a listener who has your own story about this kind of thing, give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE. You can also reach us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Thank you to both of you. At 15 minutes past the hour, let's take a look at the headlines.
Well, we've been talking about the impact of long-term unemployment on Americans. The White House has some slightly more positive news this morning. A report says 100,000 more jobs will be created each month this year on average, according to their forecasts. Iran is now a nuclear state, according to the country's president, who made the announcement at an official rally marking the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. He was referring to 20% enrichment of uranium. 20% purity is far short of weapons grade, but politically significant in Tehran.
We've been talking about the impact of long-term unemployment on Americans. The White House has some slightly more positive news this morning. A report says 100,000 more jobs will be created each month this year on average. Tens of thousands remain in the dark after back-to-back blizzards swept across the east. More than 100,000 utility customers in Pennsylvania were left without power. Some never got it back after the last storm.
In Haiti, Reuters is reporting that the American missionaries charged with kidnapping will be released and freed, perhaps as early as today. There's no confirmation on that, but the judge in the case is widely expected to rule on whether to proceed with the trial. We're going to have more on this later in the program, but South Africans are commemorating the 20th anniversary of the release from prison of Nelson Mandela, which heralded the end of white minority rule in South Africa. Mr. Mandela, who's 91, is expected to make a special State of the Union address today. Those are some of the stories we're following. Coming up, it's almost a month since Haiti was hit by a devastating earthquake. The UN chief responsible for coordinating the world's relief efforts has an update and finally has some time to join us in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first news takeout comes from Haiti, and we welcome an individual who we've been trying to reach for quite some time since the Haitian earthquake, but who for very obvious reasons has been pretty darn busy down there in Port-au-Prince. Shane Gilbert joins us, chief of the Joint Operations and Tasking Center for the United Nations in Haiti. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, John.
So, you know, the UN was one of the big victims right after the earthquake. I mean, you arrived in the country, and not only was the nation devastated, but UN operations were devastated. How did you begin to pick up the pieces when you arrived 5 days after the earthquake?
Yeah, that was a fairly traumatic experience. As you mentioned, we lost about over 40 of our staff, including our senior leadership. So the first thing we had to do was we brought down some senior people from UN headquarters in New York, and I joined one of those teams that came down, and we just started picking up the pieces. People walking around with dazed looks, basically, and just still recovering from the shock of it all. They'd had some pretty traumatic experiences as well, because they were all involved in helping the injured. We had UN staff helping with fairly triage and some pretty horrific surgeries that were happening inside tents and so forth. So it was very, almost like a combat zone down here.
You know, we're familiar with the face of the United Nations as a kind of thoughtful, diplomatic, maybe sometimes a slightly wordy, character on the world stage. You are the other face of the UN that actually gets things done, that mobilizes the kind of action end of the United Nations. What kinds of things did you have to do, and how different are you from those sober, sometimes boring speeches in the Security Council?
Yes, I've worked at both ends of the spectrum. Having my normal base is in New York, so I'm familiar with that side as well. Of course, in this situation, we're dealing with a number of member states and the host country itself, and we all share the same purpose, and that makes it a lot easier for us to act. Because we do share the same purpose, everyone was willing to work out how best we could work together. So in our role here in the JOTC, for example, all we did is we provided the opportunity for all of those member states and organizations to come together to be able to share the information that we could possibly gather, and then work with the humanitarian community to try and meet their needs that they couldn't deliver themselves. So that worked fairly well. The only difficult part, I guess, was just ensuring that we all knew how we would talk to each other and what procedures we would follow so that we wouldn't step on each other's toes. So that took a little while to do, but we got there.
Well, now you've got a huge task of getting basic food and water and a decent shelter to people, because the hurricane season is coming and the weather's going to change down there. What's your plan?
Well, we just had our first rain today, and our biggest problem right now is trying to get enough shelters to people and getting the rubble from the streets. We have a huge sanitation problem about to confront us with streets flooding, not enough latrines. So that's our major focus right now, trying to get that done before the end of this month and early March.
And we're dealing with millions and millions of people who are at risk. Shane Gilbert, Chief of the Joint Operations and Tasking Center for the United Nations in Haiti, a job definitely not completed. Thanks so much.
Turning from Haiti to the U.S. for our last takeout, time for some snow day memories from you.
It was 1947. I lived in New York City at the time, and up until that time, we had never had a snowstorm like that before.
With a blizzard yesterday that blanketed much of the East Coast and the Midwest, we were looking for the bright side of the storm, and listeners like this one showed us some great snow day stories at 8778-MY-TAKE, like Annette in Montclair, New Jersey.
And with dozens and dozens of kids, we threw snowballs at each other. We rolled in the snow. We were so upbeat. We were so happy. In those days, schools did not close on snow days because everyone was able to walk to their local school. It was a glorious time.
Patty posts to our website, thetakeaway.org. Growing up in Western Washington State, I remember the smell of oatmeal being made and the radio with the farm report playing. And then the announcement would come on that schools were closed. My three brothers and I would cheer and carry on until Mom told us to go outside. We would sled, build massive snow forts, complete with candles for warmth and light. We'd stay out until our skin started to itch from the cold. Then it was inside for hours and hours of ping pong, the best when we knew we'd be out for days. Then you could relax and enjoy. My kids were out in the snow for hours last night.
Elle sent us an email. To get a snow day, the wind chill had to be 30 degrees below zero, the kind of cold that burns the inside of your nose the second you step outside. When that happened, my friends and I were overjoyed to the point that our judgment was impaired. We'd all end up at the ski hill together, bundled beyond recognition. We'd take one run, then rush into the chalet for shelter and hot chocolate. After an hour or so, when we could finally feel our toes again, we'd take another run, then rush back into the chalet. Takes a little insanity and a lot of love for winter to take advantage of a snow day in the UP, Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And I think those days grew our Youper pride the most.
Youper, yes. All Youpers, give us a call. You know, global warming is really going to wreck the world, because memories like that will fade. I mean, yesterday in the snow, I was driving around, and all of a sudden the car, there was this thump on the windshield. I went, what is that? And I realized, it's snowballs. Of course.
Throwing snowballs.
Kids were throwing snowballs.
That was probably me. Yes, I was indeed. Actually. throwing snowballs at you. What's your take? If you have a snowy day memory, let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or go to our website. It's thetakeaway.org.
And don't forget, it's almost Friday. We team up with our friends at The Week magazine. We're looking for your nominations for who had a good week and who had a bad week.
My name is Daniel, calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. My nominee for who's having a good week is Jenny Sanford, who's been on pretty much every television show and in every newspaper for the past week. For who's having a bad week, I would say her husband, who's alone in the governor's mansion.
Yep. Now you can move on from the Sanford family if you'd like to nominate. You can send suggestions to us by posting to our website, thetakeaway.org. That's our feature with The Week magazine.
And today we're asking you about labels. You know, the psychiatric community is trying to come up with new labels for their diagnostic manual. And we're asking you, when have labels helped you or hurt you in any part of your life? It doesn't have to be a mental health issue. How have they personally helped you? What is the power of a label? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to thetakeaway.org. Coming back, we go back 20 years.
And now Mr. Mandela walks through the gate. He's a free man as of this moment.
We remember the 20-year anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release and how the country is celebrating today. That's coming up.
Coming up on the 20th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from a South African prison, we look back at that moment and look at today's commemorations. That's coming right up. But right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Pro-government protesters there in Tehran this morning cheering and marching through the streets to mark the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution and supporting their president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. The president is announcing that Iran is now a nuclear state because it produced its first batch of 20% enriched uranium, far below weapons grade. Meanwhile, anti-government protesters are being attacked by riot police who are firing tear gas to disperse them and paintballs to mark them for later arrest. In Afghanistan, U.S. Marines and Taliban fighters exchanged gunfire today in the outskirts of Marja, the militant stronghold that's expected to be the site of a major attack in the coming days.
Former Texas Congressman Charlie Wilson, who worked to funnel millions of dollars in weapons to Afghan rebels to fight the Soviets in the 1980s, has died. He was 76 years old. And the Census Bureau is changing the way inmates are counted. It'll now release data on prison populations to states before they redraw legislative districts. States will then be able to decide whether to count the prisoners in the rural regions where the prisons are usually located or count them from the city they originally came from. New foreclosure numbers for January are out.
We saw a marginal decrease in foreclosure activity in January. It was down about 10% from December. But unfortunately, it was up 15% year over year.
Realty Track's Rick Sharga says the foreclosure rate will not get better until next year. And the president of the European Union says EU leaders have reached a deal on helping Greece with its debt crisis. No details. Greece is in danger of defaulting on a $420 billion debt. Checking on the markets, Asian and European markets up, probably on that news about Greece. Futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,038. The S&P opens at 1,068 and the NASDAQ at 2147. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Hard to believe it's been 20 years. But 20 years after the dissident leader of the African National Congress, Nelson Mandela, walked free from a South African prison and became one of the most powerful political reformers in modern history. It's worth noting that two of the most acclaimed films released this year are a retelling of the iconic fable of Mandela's rise and the fall of apartheid. This is from the soundtrack of the movie District 9. It's up for a Best Picture Oscar, and it's the retelling of the liberation of the black township Soweto through a story about space aliens, quite literally. And the other film is Invictus, which is a retelling of the victory of the Springbok rugby team after the fall of apartheid, which, along with Nelson Mandela, brought the nation of South Africa together. Here's Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela.
You elected me your leader. Let me lead you now.
Mandela resonates throughout global culture, and 20 years ago today, he was released from prison after 27 years behind bars. Here's his voice speaking in 1990.
You've achieved legendary status during your years in prison, Mr. Mandela. Are you worried about living up to that legendary status?
No. There is no single individual who can undertake the enormous task of solving the problems of this country.
breathtaking. The sound of that voice so familiar. The man who conducted that interview with Nelson Mandela joins us now, James Robbins. He's now BBC diplomatic correspondent. He joins us from London. Good morning, James.
Good morning.
Also with us is Fatima Mir, a friend and biographer of Nelson Mandela. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Fatima, why do you think Nelson Mandela resonates as such an iconic figure throughout world culture even today?
It's because he is almost like the blessed figure we had in Mahatma Gandhi. He is one of those rare individuals who, when he came out of prison, it is remarkable that he never in any way...
Well, it certainly is remarkable. Fatima Mir is a biographer of Nelson Mandela, the author of Higher Than Hope, and she joins us from Durban, South Africa. What kinds of commemorations are going on around the world, James Robbins?
Well, I think the chief commemoration today is the fact that many ANC leaders, those involved in the release of Nelson Mandela 20 years ago, have gone back to the gates of Victor Verster Prison in the Cape, in the beautiful winelands of the Cape, although it can't have seemed very beautiful to Nelson Mandela coming towards the end of his 27 years in prison. And he will be the guest of honour later on today when his successor, President Jacob Zuma, makes his State of the Nation speech at the end of the day. I mean, I endorse and agree with everything that Fatima Meir was telling us. He is such a remarkable figure because he has absolutely transcended the suffering that he went through, that others went through with him in prison. He came out, of course, committed not just to continuing the struggle for a non-racial South Africa, because let's remind ourselves, 20 years ago, it was certainly not that, and there were long and difficult years of negotiation ahead with the president who released him, President F.W. de Klerk. But Nelson Mandela also came out preaching very strongly the message of forgiveness, which has taken deep root in modern South Africa.
You know, James Robbins, I'm wondering, throughout this last 20 years, Nelson Mandela has maintained his stature, but he's always been a skeptic of his own legacy and his impact on human rights in the world. Those seem to be contradictory, yet his stature has increased throughout these 20 years.
Well, I think he is quintessentially a modest man. I mean, in that little clip of a fragment of the interview that I had with him, I was privileged to have with him within a couple of days of his release back in 1990. I was pretty stunned when I asked him if he would find it hard to live up to his legendary status, and he said the single word no. I was a bit taken aback, but of course he went on to say that it wasn't him who everybody should judge and look to, but his organisation, the African National Congress. And he's always deferred to the idea of the collective will, the collective determination of the people of South Africa to be free. But there's no doubt, frankly, that without his leadership, it would have been very much more difficult to achieve that.
Fatima Mir, a biographer of Nelson Mandela, what do you think the leader in this speech that he's going to give, a State of the Nation speech that he's expected to give today, would say about the next 20 years in South Africa and in his mission for the world?
Well, we are all hoping and helping Rhodesia to recover herself. And I think that Nelson Mandela will still play a very important role there.
And, you know, he is 91. He does seem like he would live forever. Fatima Mir is a friend and biographer of Nelson Mandela. She's the author of Higher Than Hope, a biography of the man who walked out of prison 20 years ago today. James Robbins, a final thought, BBC diplomatic correspondent.
Well, just to echo some of what Fatima Mir was saying, I think that Nelson Mandela still plays an extraordinarily powerful unifying role in South Africa. And I should just say I've come back from South Africa a couple of weeks ago. I was making a film there about the 20 years of freedom we're celebrating today. And a final thought, I spent some time at the University of Cape Town with young students, 20-year-olds now, either not quite born or just being born when Nelson Mandela came out of prison. And I did that deliberately because for them this is already an event in history, important though it is. And the powerful message that came across from them was one both of great optimism, and we're talking now, of course, about black, white, Indian students, mixed race students on a campus which was predominantly white before Nelson Mandela was released. Huge optimism, coupled with, from one of them at least, a doubt about whether the unity of purpose that has guided South Africa through the last
Indeed.
20 years will outlive Nelson Mandela, because they recognize
20 years ago he walked free. James Robbins, BBC diplomatic correspondent, talking about Nelson Mandela. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Heavy winter storms have swept over the Northeast and blanketed the streets from West Virginia all the way to Massachusetts. Our nation's capital has been shut down all week with what has been the snowiest winter in D.C.'s recorded history. Snowstorms make a lot of us think about shoveling or school cancellations, maybe treacherous driving. But according to our next guest, snow has actually been a big part of our culture in this country, and it's played a big part in our history as well. Bernard Mergen is a professor emeritus of American Studies at George Washington University, author of Snow in America and Weather Matters, an American Cultural History Since 1900. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
So this goes way beyond somebody telling you to restrict your conversation to your health and the weather, right? You're saying that that weather has actually mattered in terms of shaping our American personality.
I believe so. I mean, I wouldn't ever claim that Americans are unique in their perceptions of weather, but every part of the country really has different perception based on their expectations. And that's probably the number one way in which weather affects history, is that it creates expectations about the normal, and then it challenges those expectations every once in a while.
Because it's always abnormal. Give me an example of what you're talking about.
Well, I guess there are any number of, most recently, of course, is Katrina, because of the expectations of hurricanes along the coast, but when they exceed the expectations, the result is catastrophe and the soul-searching that comes afterward. And so we seem to go through cycles of these. I'm interested in my books in the way, maybe not the big sort of way in which the wind sank the Armada or the iceberg sank the Titanic or something, in the way that weather changes history, but in the way that weather constantly nudges us in certain directions. That is, I'm thinking there was a long time in which the Weather Bureau refused to acknowledge the term tornado. The weather forecasters from 1880s through the 1930s were not supposed to mention tornadoes in their forecasts, because there was a fear that they would panic people and the predictions weren't very good. But the great tornadoes in 1925, the so-called tri-state tornado in Missouri, Indiana, and Illinois, which killed between 600 and 900 people, really forced the Weather Bureau to rethink its approach. And again, in 1933, the Navy dirigible, the Akron, crashed in a storm off Atlantic City. And a lot of people blamed the Weather Bureau for being too slow to adopt new methods of forecasting. And so President Roosevelt appointed a very high-level commission, including the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Millikan, and they completely revamped the Weather Bureau in the 30s. So I'm looking at these things that maybe don't make the headlines, but affect the way in which we are dealing with the weather today, because the Weather Bureau has changed to keep up with the times.
And certainly in each region of the country, they have a different view of holidays, whether it be July 4th or Christmas or something else, depending on what the weather looks like out their window. That's Bernard Mergen, Professor Emeritus of American Studies at George Washington University.
He's kind of the Howard Zinn of snow, I think. Historian,
the
social
people's
historian.
History of snow?
Yeah. Yes, I think so.
Snow in America is his book. He also wrote Weather Matters, an American Cultural History Since 1900. Thanks so much, Professor Mergen.
And I brought me some corn for popping. The lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
I'm Celeste Headlee, here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, the sounds of civil rights music echoing through the halls of the White House, and we have two of the performers here to talk about that music in just a few moments. First, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The White House has some positive news this morning on the jobs front. A report from the Council of Economic Advisers says an average of 100,000 more jobs will be created each month this year across the country. But of course, many Americans continue to battle unemployment. Earlier, we spoke to Donald Jones, a 60-year-old unemployed takeaway listener from Detroit.
You sort of feel an isolation, even though in Detroit you're not exactly isolated when you're unemployed.
Stock futures on Wall Street are perking up. World markets have been shaken by worries that debt trouble in countries like Greece will unravel the economic recovery. Today, though, the European Union president said coordinated measures will be taken to help debt-strapped Greece. And here at home, Citigroup has announced a pilot program which will allow homeowners who are about to face foreclosure to stay in their property. They'll be allowed to stay in their homes for an extra 6 months rather than face immediate eviction.
In Iran, President Ahmadinejad appeared in an official rally marking the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. He announced that Iran is now a nuclear state after producing its first consignment of 20% enriched uranium, which is well below actual weapons grade. In Haiti, 10 missionaries charged with child kidnapping should hear from the judge deciding their fate. The judge will decide today if they face trial for child trafficking. Finally, a little story we spotted for you this morning. The social networking site Facebook has deleted the pages of 30 convicted prisoners in Britain following an intervention by a government minister. The Justice Secretary, Jack Straw, said that the prisoners were using the site to taunt victims, to communicate with conspirators, and to boast about their crimes. Facebook agreed to delete the pages. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
That song, Lord, I Done Done What You Told Me To Do, resounded through the halls of the White House on Tuesday night. That's the voices of the Howard University Choir. They were part of a White House performance series that's called A Celebration of Music from the Civil Rights Movement. The event included artists like Jennifer Hudson, Bob Dylan, John Legend, and many others. It'll be broadcast on most PBS stations tonight at 8 p.m. And we have two members of the Howard University Choir with us this morning. Good morning to Dr. James Weldon Norris. He's the conductor and director of the choir and a music professor at Howard. And his grandson, Brandon D. Strong, a singer and manager of the choir. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Dr. Norris, you have a long career, but you actually arranged that song that we were just hearing from the Howard University Choir, which was performed at the White House. How did you write this song, Lord, I Done Done?
Well, you must remember I was raised in South Carolina, and my grandfather was a Baptist minister. So traveling with him throughout my youth, I heard these old church songs sung frequently. So this is an old black church tune that's absolutely just fascinates me every time I would hear it. It would usually be sung often after communion or sometimes at funerals and things like that. And so we were performing one night in Connecticut during the Beethoven Ninth. And on the way back, the bus was quiet. So I took out my music paper and my pen, and I started to jot this tune down and do the arrangement. And I'm so glad I did, because I just love it very much.
You know, the Howard University Choir, I'm sure they sing a number of spirituals, and the singing of spirituals with university choirs, it doesn't have as long of a history, perhaps, as many people think. Here's a recording of the Fisk Jubilee Singers from 1955. Fisk Singers were actually the first choir, really, to bring spirituals into the concert hall. And at the time, it was kind of revolutionary. The singing of spirituals was not entirely accepted by the African-American community.
Well, at this particular time, I don't think that you could say it wasn't accepted by the African-American community. But at the time, the original Fisk Jubilee Singers did that. It's that most people just didn't get a chance to hear them. The Fisk Jubilee Singers, I happen to have been the beginning, let's say, of the Negro spiritual as a concert art form. And they really made it into one and developed one. It's absolutely fantastic the way they did it. In the later years, I think it became somewhat unpopular, let's say, to sing spirituals on college campuses and things, because we were just going into a new light It was very unfortunate.
You kind of wanted to. People felt like you wanted to move on. Is that what you mean?
So what now?
The people felt like they should move on from the Negro spiritual tradition.
Yes, they didn't want to sing these old songs. Reminded them of old times. They said, you know, one of those things. And it was very unfortunate. But then it began to revive. And with many of the traditional black colleges in America, you know, which were church-owned, the spiritual began to be popular again, and people began to sing them and have a new respect for them and a new light for them.
Well, let's ask a younger generation. Your grandson, Brandon D. Strong, a singer with the Howard University Choir. Brandon, how do you feel about the singing of these, what your grandfather just called, old songs?
Well, for my generation, we can't really relate to the music. However, it does mean something to us. And especially the other night, singing in the White House, you got a sense of the African diaspora, what it means to be the descendants of African Americans, and like a conceptual view of your culture.
But you don't feel a connection when you sing the words. That doesn't make you call up any special connection between you and the songs.
No, ma'am. Honestly, because these songs, most of the time, were used as coping mechanisms, like he said, in funerals. Then you have chain gang songs, and they were songs that represented what was going on at the time. And in my generation, we haven't had to go through struggles in the same right that they have. And our music that speaks through us now is so much different.
Who was you were there, Brandon, singing with a lot of famous performers. Who was the person you're most excited to sing near?
Honestly, Bob Dylan. Being on the same program as Bob Dylan struck a chord with me.
And you left right before Natalie Cole and Jennifer Hudson took the stage, is that right?
We left after Jennifer Hudson and Smokey Robinson sang, but before the Blind Boys of Alabama performed.
Oh, they're great.
Dr. James,
because of the snow.
Oh, yeah, you had to travel out of D.C. before you got stuck there and couldn't get back to Howard University. You know, Dr. James Weldon Norris, it's very difficult for me to not associate your name with the famous civil rights singer James Weldon Johnson. You wouldn't happen to have been named after him, were you?
I was. James Weldon Johnson and my father were fraternity brothers. And so my mother tells me, and he insisted I be named after him.
I was just going to say, Johnson was a teacher at Fisk.
He was a teacher at Fisk, yes. He was a teacher at Fisk, a great writer. And he and his brother, J. Roseman Johnson, were great musicians. And they collaborated quite a bit. So you can see that his writing, Lift Every Voice and Sing, and our performing it, often it means so very, very much to me. Because if you actually dissect that poetry with a surgical scalpel, I call it, you will find that every line is a sermon.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's a magnificent piece of music.
Lift Every Voice and Sing is often called the African-American National Anthem, written by James Weldon Johnson. And we've been listening to the voices of James Weldon Norris. He's the conductor and director of the choir at Howard University, also a music professor there. His grandson, Brandon D. Strong, is a singer and manager of the choir. Here is the song that one of the songs the Howard University Choir performed at the White House on Wednesday, arranged by Dr. James Weldon Norris.
You can hear the whole song, Lord, I Done Done What You Told Me to Do, as performed by the Howard University Choir on our website, thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, we have some work for you, a special project that needs your photos.
God loves a terrier.
The Westminster Dog Show is coming up next week, and we're having our own dog best-in-show show. Send us a photo of your four-legged friend, and we'll do the best-in-show judging with our listeners. Post your photos on our Facebook page, and we'll talk about them next week. You can get instructions on how to post your pet pictures, dog pictures, at thetakeaway.org. You and your little dog at The Takeaway.
I'm going to post a picture of my beagle.
And your little dog, too. I'm John Hockenberry. It's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.